Welcome to Bipolar Vortex, Tales from the Tunnel. I'm your host, Kelly Anchors, and I am here with my sister, Allison, and her friend, Dan. And what will follow is a conversation.
Hi, I'm Allison, Kelly's sister, and I'm here today with my wonderful friend Dan, who is the best person on planet Earth. How did we meet, Dan?
How did we meet? We met because we were out with a bunch of people and we didn't know each other, and I was talking about some stuff. Wait, I have to tell you something. And I was like, who is this crazy person who's running up to me that wants my attention so desperately? And then what you told me just blew my mind right out of my head. And I was like,
I remember Dan was going through something. And maybe this is a completely separate conversation we had, because there's been many over the years. But I remember he was going through something with someone and going through kind of a dark time, and somebody had behaved in an unkind or inappropriate way, as I recalled. The details escape me. And him just being such a sunny, loving, like with this childlike joy and innocence, I could tell he kind of felt bad about the situation, even while knowing it was still wrong. And I remember just off the top of my head making this comment saying, well, you know, recognizing the connection that I felt with him, that we're both like two kids. We're both like, we just share a lot of innocence and joy and purity, and we love that aspect of ourselves. So I told him that, you know, we're both like children. We're very lovely and joyous to be around, and it's very warm in our sun, but it's very cold in our shadow. And
that's exactly what you said to me.
And I wasn't making apologies about that either.
No, and that was why I connected with that so strongly, because around the time I met you, I was really just starting to understand that as being the truth, as being part of the process. And I needed that. So that I needed somebody to come and say, it's okay to take your son away and go give it to somebody who's actually going to appreciate it, like who's actually going to, you know, bask in you instead of keep trying to throw rain clouds over it. You know what I mean? And because just as a concept, that had never occurred to me. You know what I mean? I was all about just like, here I am, here's my son, wait a minute, what's wrong? You know? And that was such a revelation. You know, particularly when you deal with mental illness and addiction and whatever else you have going on, some people are just not healthy for that. And that sucks, but it's just true.
And one thing I've found along that same line with humility is that the more I go on my path of just trying to find my place in the world, trying to live in my skin, live in my personal integrity, stretch myself out of my comfort zone, all the all-encompassing things of everyday mindfulness and trying to live an awakened life, you know, is that I do not get stronger.
People,
yeah.
You can't grow. You can't progress. You can't kind of realize yourself.
So I do want to talk. I want to jump in and talk about toxic. Because one of the parts of my podcast is that I do think toxic is really hard to do. Especially when it comes to people. And I understand how you guys are doing what I believe and correct me if I'm wrong. But it's somebody who's got a lot of negative stuff going on, mental illness, whatever, and they're not doing it. Toxic to me.
That's correct. Well, Allison and I talked about this all time. I think this comes up. I think it comes up every time we talk.
Yeah.
Seeking out
abusive, either low level or high level, even subconsciously abusive situations that feel like love.
I mean, it's so subtle sometimes.
It is. It is.
It's not just about love relationships and friendships, but we
across the board.
Right. We take these patterns that we learn as kids and as young adults, teenagers, whatever, and then we take it out into the outside world, and we think that that's the way you're supposed to act. We think that that's how people are supposed to treat you. And
yeah.
If we can't find that, we'll go make it, you know, because it's, I remember reading somewhere once that a lot of times, for example, people who come from abuse backgrounds choose abusive partners because it's familiar. And not because they want to be abused or they like being abused, but it's because there's a weird comfort in that. And that same pattern because it feels like home.
Yeah.
And, you know, I almost want to cry when I say that because it's so sad. I've been able to go back and look at, for example, my childhood and realize, you know, I don't have a lot of finger pointing that I can do. You know, I know I was a difficult child, and I don't think neither of my parents really came from a background where they had any experience with this. My mother's family is very different. My mother's that, you know, if I'm dead, I can't listen to, like, my favorite Sex Pistols album kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Awesome.
It was like,
yeah.
So it really, really did save my life. It was ridiculous. I was 12 or 13, and my parents finally got concerned enough that they sent me into therapy. I went to see a psychologist, and he was the first person I labeled my father as an alcoholic. He was also the first person to suggest that my family was dysfunctional. He was the first person I ever heard use the word abuse, and this just was all news to me.
Yeah.
You know? Because that's the sad thing about it, is that because we're self-centered, because we're so turned inward, we think this is normal.
Yep. We have nothing to compare it to.
Right. And it just shocked the hell out of me when he said this. I was like, no. I've seen TV shows about, you know, husbands that keep their wives and stuff like that. And that's
isn't
not
that.
Family. And he's like, isn't it? My little 12-year-old girl. He's basically saying, well, what do you call this then? You know, and I'm thinking, like we're talking about, I'm thinking, well, I call this normal. I call this the life that I've always had. And he's going, no, not everybody looks like this. You do realize that, right? And I remember talking to him on the phone, just crying because I realized at that point, like, this is not right. Like, this is not, you know.
It made sense.
Yeah.
It was lining up, like, for the first time.
For the first time, yeah.
It was only when I realized that when I put down the drugs and the booze that were just absolutely helping deaden my feelings, you know what I mean, and started as a result coming back to all the pain of life and everything, because like once you remove the symptoms of what was really wrong with me and it all came rushing back to the surface.
You know, being given the diagnosis of depression is depressing. As a 12-year-old, for someone to say, oh yeah, you know, you have this, and you poor thing, it wasn't, you know, we didn't discuss it in terms of, well, you know, you can still have a fantastic life, and you can still really move forward, and you can still,
yeah.
It was more like, you know,
sucks to be you.
Yeah, sucks to be you, and I mean, that's the way I took it, kid, right, that's the way I took it, and so I just think I never envisioned. I think I just kind of became resigned to the fact that, you know, there was always going to be this black cloud kind of following around. And I was able to lose myself in music for quite a long time. But
I want to ask about the music, because the music treated it, and the drums almost fed it in a positive way a little bit, but did it ever prevent you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, and that is probably the one thing that I deal with the most, the way it impacts me the most, is this inability sometimes to just get moving and to get that forward momentum.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, over the years, when I first found out about this, when I first got the diagnosis, it was all about being sad, feeling down, or being lonely, whatever. And over the years, with the help of some really wonderful people, you know, I learned how to identify these different emotions. Absolutely.
Oh yeah. God, yes.
It's like the catch-22 is, if I get myself into recovery, even being here right now with you guys, I'm great. I'm engaging, I'm making something, like I'm in a show, I'm in a theater, I'm thrilled with my body. I am not depressed.
Yeah.
But sometimes I would give away everything that I care about if I could just not have to have a call.
This low energy thing, life is a game of frickin' inches. I work around my bipolar. I work around my depression. It's like, if I'm super flat out depressed and don't want to do nothing, guess what? I get out, I ain't gonna make the bed, but I'll put the covers over it.
I mean, so you know? Like when it's really, really bad for me, what Michael does is he'll just pull me out, shove me out the door.
I'm glad you said what you said about just getting out of bed and getting moving.
Yeah.
That's something that I've come to understand. It is about momentum.
It's about motivation.
And
fake it.
The analogy that somebody gave you was, you know, if you're rolling a stone, if the stone is moving, it's so much easier to push it and make it go faster. But the stone is stopped, it takes so much more effort to get it moving again. So the idea is just to keep rolling the stone.
So music was, like I said, it was kind of a salvation. It was, not kind of, it was a salvation. There's no other way to say it. It kept me going. It gave me something to hope for. It gave me something to connect with. And it let me, it's funny because in some ways I turned very inward because the musical process was all about me and all about what I'm doing and all about my goals and what I'm trying to accomplish. But at the same time, it got me outside of myself because it allowed me to not focus on things like how unhappy I was, how depressed I was, how screwed up my home life was, how much, you know, how much chaos was around me. The music was something, it was a touchstone, it was something tangible that I could hold on to and say, okay, this is good. In the middle of all of this crap, this is good and this I like. You know, and in a way, it became almost a type of addiction. I mean, my whole life began to revolve around music as much as I possibly could. Now, later on, in my late teens, that's when I really discovered alcohol, and then after that, drugs. And I think the only thing that kept me from using those things to self-medicate earlier, because I do see it as self-medicating, and this is a common theme that I have heard from a whole lot of other people. There's a whole lot of people out there that start you know, using alcohol and drugs in an unhealthy way, because, you know, I don't mean to suggest that, you know, everybody should, you know, completely abstain or whatever. Hey, if it brings you joy, and knock yourself out, you know. But to use them in an unhealthy way, which is to gloss over other things that are happening, to not deal with issues, to use them to soothe your pain, to use them to, right, kill your mind, all the rest of that stuff. That to me is unhealthy. For me, that's an unhealthy way to use them, and that's the way I started using them. And of course, once you discover that level of escape, it's really hard. Nothing else compares, you know. And, right. So, you know, for a long time, there was this battle going on between, you know, drugs, music, and the music won. I'm really glad to say. one of the most helpful things that anybody told me was another guy that I met who was also, you know, recovering from substance abuse. And I was whining to him one day saying, you know, I'm never going to make good music again. I'm never going to be the kind of musician I want to be because, you know, all my heroes are junkies, man. You know, and which is still kind of true. I mean, if I go down the list of all the musicians that I admire and you know, 90% of them, you know, have been very publicly known as, you know, having used drugs. And I was trying to use this whole rationalization that, like, well, you know, the drugs are the muse, man. The drugs are the fuel for the creativity, man. You know, and he was like, well, yeah, you could look at it that way, but I really choose to look at it from a different vantage point, which is those people that you admire had the talent and they worked on their craft and they honed their, you know, they honed their skills and all that. Just imagine how much better their music might have been or how much more music they could have made if they hadn't had that monkey on their back. And that was a revelation for me. I never thought about that, you know. And that completely changed my perspective because until that point, you know, I had bought into this whole kind of rock and roll fantasy of, you know, sex and drugs and rock and roll and all that stuff, and not realizing that, you know, this is a small section.
And it's so much richer, like, and I'm sure it's informed your creativity and some music when you, like Pima Chodron says, when you stop running from your fear and you turn on your face and lean into it, and when you explore it, like whether you're a musician or an artist or a comedian, I always find it much richer and more fascinating when, like, you know, losing is a reaction, you know, to the pain, you know, and all this stuff, and it's like,
yeah, I mean, you know, you try not to live your life in regret. So, and you know, there's still that part of me that looks back and a lot of time that I spent doing that and thinking, you know, boy, I could have really been a lot more productive, you know. But at the same time, it, like you said, it informs and it, it's, I feel like I kind of have the best of both worlds because I have the, you know, whatever inspiration or spiritual unlocking or whatever that I was going to get from that. But I'm not a slave to it anymore. I don't have to, you know, I don't have to sit down and like, oh, I'm going to light up a big bowl and then write a song if, you know, if I don't nod out, you know, or like if the drugs don't run out or, you know, if the liquor store isn't closed, you know. But I can draw on that, and I think it allows me to connect to the world in a bigger way. One of the big problems that I've seen in myself, definitely, but that I see in other musicians, you know, particularly struggling musicians, is an inability to reach people because what you're talking about is so small and so closed off, so self-centered, so personal that it's like, that's a really good song, but it just goes right past me because I don't relate, you know? So I think that the things like my struggle with depression, things like my years spent, you know, overindulging in substances, things like my rocky childhood, I think you roll them all together and they make you a more complete person and they allow you then to connect with more people on more different levels. And
They're the things that connect us to the species. You know, it's like, I used to think of other people as super, like, fearful and this jagged, dangerous view of the world. And the more you, like, the layers of the onion, the more you familiarize with your pain. And you get down with it. Like,
how does the onion just always work itself into these conversations?
That's an onion. But it's like, but now people aren't so scary to me, and it's like people can relate more to your music because what you're with, it's not unique, it's relatable. It's like when you follow it down to like if something upsets you, you follow the echo effect. Wow, this feels really emotionally charged for this situation. Where did this come from? Let's dig, let's dig, mm-hmm. let's dig. And the more you dig, you're getting into this kind of like something that everyone can relate to. Mm-hmm. You know?
I like to think so. I like to think it really makes it, you know, because any kind of creative endeavor you're doing, you're trying to communicate. You're trying to reach people. You're trying to elicit a reaction. You're trying to make a connection. You know, you're trying to change the way people feel, give people a new perspective. So it's all about connecting. It's all about reaching out. It's all about sending some kind of message.
I just wanted to jump in and say something because it hit me when I was about what my theater and my writing is for me too at the age I am now. It used to be something else, but for me now it is mine and nobody can take it from me. And that is something I think is ripening of an artist when you mm-hmm. get to the point where it's not just how many people can I sell tickets to right. or who right. will recognize me, but this is mine. This is yeah. me and nobody gets to take it. And I don't know, like there's just something about that. And I was just saying at the theater meeting 2 days ago, you know, there was just a time in my life where it was so important. Numbers were really important.
Mm-hmm.
But now I can produce like, you know, an hour show where people walk in and went, wow, like that was complete. That was good. Whatever it is.
Right,
but it's
right.
something that, you know, hell yeah, I'm fine. I swear to God. And that is not me in my 20s or even my 30s. But it's no, look at the world. Look at what people like. I'm just saying, like, numbers are just not an indication of much.
You know, ask yourself, could I walk away from this? Could I put this down? Could I go do something else? Could I stop writing? Could I stop acting? Could I stop being, you know? And if the answer is no, if the answer feels like I think I would die, then you know.
And then you just keep going.
Right.
Go.
Then what does it matter? I mean, because you're going to keep going whether anybody's listening or not, right? If it's important, it's important. That's how music has become entrenched in my life. And I have my down periods. I have my, you know, I've had serious gaps where I was dealing with issues or I was, you know, my self-confidence got completely blown or whatever, but I always come back to it because it doesn't go away. It's almost compulsive, but it's a healthy compulsion,
yeah,
you know, because
it is.
And being in touch with your creativity and expressing yourself is always healthy for me.
Do you ever play out?
Like, yes.
Okay, so...
Not recently, because Jason, who's the other person in my band, we have been focused on trying to record.
Okay.
We've been focused on trying to get something out, like something concrete, you know, something that you can download, something that we can, you know, give away, sell, whatever.
This is, at some point, whenever you've got something ready, we'll put it back on the website so people
cool.
can download it.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
Yeah, that'd be
appreciate
awesome.
It.
Anyway, it's been lovely, you guys. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you, and just your friendship's really fun to watch.
I'm a little bit jealous.
Well, thank you. You're welcome to join. Yeah, and thank you for giving us an excuse to just hang out and be ourselves, because I don't get to see this lovely woman nearly often enough.
Behind the visor of your helmet, my little spacesuit baby, where all the promises float in the void, my little spacesuit baby. I lost you.